This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone. Over the past decade, Elizabeth Warren has become a progressive icon.
Perhaps the most powerful elected voice among the progressives right now.
I'd love Elizabeth Warren to be vice president. I'd love her to be anything. I'd love her to be a female Ghostbuster.
But the senator has struggled with a personal issue since she first ran for office in 2012.
Ms. Warren, I want to start with questions about your Native American heritage. You've acknowledged that you listed yourself as a minority in a faculty directory in 1986. You continued to list yourself in those directories until 1995. Do you consider yourself a minority? And if not...
I have answered this question many, many times. And it starts with the fact that from the day I was born until the day my mother died, she told me about who I am, who we are, who my brothers are, who my family is.
Just a ticking of a box, personal family lore, a small set of data points, and yet ones on which Warren's opponents, most notably President Trump, pounced.
She said because her cheekbones were high, she was an Indian, that she was Native American.
In July, he escalated.
I will give you $1 million to your favorite charity, paid for by Trump, if you take the test and it shows you're an Indian.
This week, Warren responded by way of a 5.5-minute pre-campaign video. In it, she speaks with Carlos Bustamante, a Stanford genetics professor who examined her DNA.
In the senator's genome, we did find 5 segments of Native American ancestry with very high confidence.
The facts suggest that you guys
absolutely have a Native American ancestor in your pedigree.
The response was probably not what Warren had anticipated.
She came out and thought she scored it first.
Yes.
And so did the media. And they started demanding Donald Trump pay off the $1 million bet. And then all of a sudden now she's at war with the Cherokee Nation. And
saying that her use of the DNA test is inappropriate and, quote, undermining tribal interests.
From both the right and the left, opprobrium. Accusations that she's not Native enough, that she's reinforcing biological essentialism, that she's falling for a Trump trap before the midterms, that she's trying to claim Native identity without ever defending Native issues, that she allowed a university to use her to bolster its diversity bona fides. A political miscalculation, but also a stumble into controversies that extend far beyond politics.
There's a running joke in Indian country where people say, oh yeah, some other person told me that they have a Cherokee great-grandmother or a Cherokee princess in their lineage. And so when we're out in the world and we meet people and they say, oh, you're Native? Oh, my great-grandmother was Cherokee. Our first response is to try not to roll our eyes.
Kim Tallbear is a professor of Native Studies at the University of Alberta and author of Native American DNA, Tribal Belonging and the False Promise of Genetic Science.
This story for us has a much longer timeline than I think many Americans understand. Elizabeth Warren's appropriation of Native identity, despite her disclaimers, I don't mean to sound cliche, but everything that's taken from Indigenous people, be it actual land and resources, or be it, you know, an image that can be marketed and used for a football team, or taking claims to ancestry and making those part of the identity that one is espousing to the world. Our understandings of kinship and family and tribe are not governed so strongly by the idea of having distant, unnamed ancestry. We have a much stronger sense of what it is to be Native American that is governed by our family relationships, by lived social relations. That matters to us.
We know in the 50s, Watson and Crick discovered the double helix structure of DNA. And ever since, talk of blood as lineage and fate have given way to conversations about mitochondrial DNA and all the rest. At the same time, there are old metaphors that persist. You can still be related either by blood or by marriage. So talk about how the contrast between scientific jargon and traditional blood talk plays out in Native culture.
I caution people against equating blood with genes. These are pretty different ideas. When you are looking at tribal citizenship rules, even if they talk about something like blood quantum, these are fractions on paper that point to very particular ancestors. The Dawes Allotment Act at the turn of the 20th century distributed 160-acre parcels of land to heads of household, and of course only men in settler ideas of family at the time could be heads of household. They would get another 80 acres if they had a wife. Women become economically tied to men. That's not how it was in many indigenous communities. Women were not economically tied to men. And then the man gets another 40 acres for each child. But in order to manage those land allotments, you had to have a register of Indians. Well, tribes and First Nations and other indigenous communities didn't necessarily have lists with names of their people and their kin. These are fluid kinship groups, right? But now we live with the legacy of those registers, and that's how tribal enrollment is governed. Mm. What we care about is proving that you are descended from somebody on the base roll that was constructed during that time.
And by the base roll, you're talking about families that were listed at the end of the 1800s.
Yeah. When you see on the back of my tribal enrollment card that I'm 1/32nd this, 1/16th this, 1/4 of this tribe, those are all particular ancestors that they're pointing to. That 1/4 Cheyenne Arapaho blood, quote unquote, is my grandfather, Randy Tallbear. It's not as if blood, the physiological substance, is being examined. We're really talking about symbolic blood, and we're pointing to named people. And so this is the problem with Elizabeth Warren taking a DNA test that's pointing to some distant, probable, unnamed ancestor that nobody knows who they were affiliated with or who they were. For us, it's who's your mom? Who's your grandma? Who's your great-grandfather? Who are your cousins? Who are your aunties and uncles?
You say your daughter doesn't get to be a citizen of the tribe because of these blood quantum rules.
So in my tribe, the Sistan-Wahpeton Oyate, they will enroll you if you are descended from somebody on the base roll. But in my tribe, in addition, they have a requirement that you must meet a total 1/4 Indian blood quotient. They will accept the blood, there's always scare quotes around that word, from multiple tribes. So even though I don't have 1/4, quote-unquote, Dakota blood, I have Cheyenne and Arapaho blood. That's where you begin to see the racial inflection, I think. So my daughter, if you were to calculate all her ancestors, because I'm supposedly 1/32nd Native American, my daughter would be 1/2 of that because her father's non-Native. Now, if my tribe decides to move to a 1/8 total Indian blood rule instead of 1/4, my daughter and her couple of cousins who can't get enrolled will be able to get enrolled. Mm-hmm. And we debate this. Every year we've got, you know, debates and conversations on our reservation. Should we go from 1/4 total Indian blood down to 1/8? And I think eventually we will. You do see tribes across the country moving away from a blood quantum standards more towards lineal descent rules to try to make our rules more inclusive. But that's up to us to debate. We don't need the rest of Americans telling us what we should do and how colonized we are by race. Everybody's colonized by race. Tribal governments and tribal communities are doing the best we can to try to tweak those rules to include our traditional notions of kinship. But within a structure that has been deeply shaped by colonial power, we're at a severe power imbalance with the U.S. federal government.
Do you think that Warren was basically played by Trump, drawn into this? Because it doesn't seem that she got any kind of educational or financial advantage by her association with the Cherokee, and it may have been part of her family lore. Do you think that she just got played into a discussion of race and blood and women, and this is something Masha Gessen said in The New Yorker, you know, all the things that Trump loves to talk about in order to defend herself against his taunt?
You know, I don't think he has the intellectual ability to play somebody who is as intelligent as Elizabeth Warren. Mm-hmm. I mean, really. She has for her entire life, like many people in Oklahoma, in the South, and in the East of the U.S., lived with this myth of an Indian in her family tree. And that's really important to those people. She's probably really invested in defending her family's story. I've seen people break down crying when they find out that they don't have a Native American ancestor. This is a cherished idea for a lot of non-Native Americans.
But you're saying it's really irrelevant even if they did.
Right. But for non-Native people who have a settler colonial idea of kinship and ancestry and family, finding that genetic proof is important to them.
Why do you think they do it?
I think they're very much influenced by that one drop rule that is so prominent in racial discourse in the United States. I have one drop back there somewhere, therefore I can make a claim. That is very racialized thinking. And again, Native people in the U.S. are not completely exempt from that. We struggle with that because it's imposed on us. But we also have this much more powerful way of identifying that's about kinship and tribe and citizenship that helps us mitigate some of the desire to invoke race in that way. But for non-Native people, that's all they got.
So what was your reaction to the controversy over Warren's video presentation of her link to the Cherokees?
When I finally sat down and watched that video the other night, literally, I started to feel nauseous and I felt slightly grief-stricken for a moment. And it's not often that that feeling of grief comes up for me because I've lived my whole life with the kind of Indigenous erasure that we have in the U.S. But that video really brought to light the deeply held ideas in the U.S. popular imagination about how everybody can claim to be Native, to have an ancestor in the family, without actually having lived relations with Native people. It just, I don't know, something in that video crystallized for me the deep power imbalance that exists between Indigenous people and everybody else. Our voices just don't matter. Our definitions of who we are just don't matter because our images are so much more important to non-Native people as they romanticize this American past. So who we are as people in and of ourselves is not important. We are only tokens that help most Americans feel comfortable in a land that's been stolen. I don't know how to put it more specifically than that.
Rebecca Nagel wrote last year in Think Progress, she said that as contemporary Native Americans, the Trumps and Warrens of the world leave very little space for us to exist, which, when you understand the history of the United States, makes perfect sense.
Yes, Rebecca Nagel put it perfectly. Yes, I agree.
Dr. Tallbear, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me on.
Dr. Kim Tallbear is a professor of Native Studies at the University of Alberta.